Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. This time, I'm joined by a returning guest, Josh Siefel. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Seth.
And we are going to be talking about Starship Troopers by Robert Heinlein, which won the 1960 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Josh, since you're a returning guest, we don't have to recapitulate your whole nerdy history or anything like that, but what have you been up to?
Well, I have been, like most of us, in the middle of this crazy pandemic season, just hoping that it would be over, and it's not over, so right. We continue on. I work full-time at a university, so that's been fun this last year.
Yeah,
as we've been doing our best to keep our students safe and still have a university, we've mm-hmm. been hanging in there.
And last time we talked to you, we were out in New Jersey, and now you're back in Seattle, right?
That's right. I did actually, I don't know how many people did this, but at one point in the pandemic last year, my wife and I just picked up stakes and kind of went to New Jersey for a couple months and then did it again at Christmas time. So I was in exile for a little while, but now I'm back in Seattle area.
Nice. And yeah. You've been podcasting.
I have, yes. I started a podcast called Christianity Now, which comes out of our College of Ministry here. We train ministers here at Northwest University. And so I tried to start a podcast. It's still in its, you know, awkward infancy, discussing issues related to Christianity and topics that arise in our emerging 21st century, which, as you know, is a lot of things. So I try to bring on some different guests from different perspectives to just have conversations all like this, one-on-one, like you have on this podcast,
yeah.
in a different subject area.
Yeah, I saw you poached one of my previous guests as well.
I did. Yeah. Jason Duman. Yeah, he's a local pastor here, and he actually did his doctoral work on preaching and I think comedy, which was very kind of interesting too. So we talked about that.
Yeah, that was an interesting episode. It's funny because I've been listening to the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast
recently. Yeah.
And they talk several times about how Mark Driscoll definitely had that comic timing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that kind of tied in well to that episode that you did.
Yeah, you know, doing a little podcast makes me realize, regardless of what everyone thinks of the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast, how much more sophisticated their podcast is
right?
than mine.
Yeah.
So we'll get there.
Yeah, I won't.
Maybe not. No, I probably won't either.
I don't have any ambitions in that direction. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a professional podcast. It's a fan podcast. So
yeah,
totally absolutely. Fine with it being what it is. So I think the history of us doing this episode kind of goes back to when I was doing the Comfort Reads episodes, and I just kind of ran out of bandwidth to do that. But you had volunteered to do something, and I went, sure, yeah, we'll get to that eventually. And then eventually I went, we probably won't eventually get to that. Maybe down the line, if I get some more time at work, I've taken on an assignment that's going to last the rest of this year. And so I just don't have the bandwidth to do extra reading
or
extra podcast editing. But you had also at some point said, hey, if you ever need a repeat guest, here's a couple titles in order of preference. And I saw that you had put Starship Troopers in there, and I thought, I've got some big books coming up, and that's one that I could just pick up on audio because I've read it before. It's one of the 12 Hugo winners that I had read prior to starting doing the podcast. And then I went on vacation last week. It was kind of a last minute spur of the moment free condo on the Big Island of Hawaii. All we have to do is pay to get over there.
Yeah, you don't turn that down.
No, you don't turn that down. And so, I was waiting for my audiobook hold to come through from the library, but I have the ebook. And so on the plane on the way over, I started reading it and read about 2/3 of it and then finished it the next day. So that worked out really well.
Yeah, I had read this years ago. And so I rarely do I do audiobooks for Hugo's, but since I'd read it, a week or two ago, I listened to the whole audiobook on audio.
Which, oh, nice.
Very different experience. I don't do that a lot with science fiction. It was it was kind of fun, but... Well, as we'll talk about, when we got to the dense philosophy sections, I had to rewind a couple of times and be like, what are they saying right now?
Yeah, it gets a little wordy in places. So what is your history with this book? I mean, why was this on the top of the list?
Well, I think one of the things for me, when I transitioned from being a Star Trek novel reader to saying I want to actually dig deeper into some of the classics of sci-fi, I think I came on to, you know, Asimov and some of the other greats, you know, relatively early on. And Heinlein, obviously, is a huge name up there. I think some people call him the Big Three, Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, and Robert Heinlein. And so that was right there. I mean, I'd read the book before, and probably I read it back probably around 97 when that movie came out.
Which there we go.
I know it's not supposed to be very good. I can hardly remember it, except that I confess to my wife that I do remember that Denise Richards was in it. But I think I read it around then. They're very different. So I'm actually I was waiting until after we recorded this podcast. I'm going to watch the movie this week because I'm curious about it. But, and then I noticed you've been doing this for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years now. No one has picked this book. It's a classic.
Yeah.
It blew my mind. I mean, there's some books on there that don't look very interesting and are still left, which I understand. But this,
right.
I just blew my mind that no one had picked this. And so I felt like I was given like Dune to review or something. Right. So I just jumped right to it.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, because I expected, I think, and I was looking back at our email exchange and I was surprised that this one hasn't been picked up yet. Now, I know Heinlein arouses strong feelings, and there's a lot of people that don't like his stuff. I've enjoyed everything I've read of his, other than I didn't really like A Stranger in a Strange Land, or Stranger in a Strange Land, I guess it is. But yeah, I figured that, you know, Ender's Game, Dune, a couple of the others would go quickly, and I figured Starship Hyperion, Troopers would as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hyperion, exactly.
Yeah, you know, I think I have a similar interaction with Heinlein, although maybe I would go back and read Stranger in a Strange Land again. Again, it was in that probably in late teens, early 20s that I read a bunch of Heinlein stuff. Yeah. And Stranger in a Strange Land is just like a drug-induced trip, man, or something. It's wild. And I didn't grok it very much, but actually, this was fun too. I think I might have first read some Heinlein. He did a whole series of short stories called, that was collected together later, called The Future History. A lot of short stories and novels pieced together, of which Starship Troopers, I think, is not a part. But when I was in college, I guess I rented a house, a basement apartment from a professor, and I guess he was an old school sci-fi fan, and he had a book, a collection of these, and I would just read them there, and just a great set of stories. So I haven't read much of Heinlein's juvenile novels, which is what he wrote, I think, a lot before before this book in 59. But, you know, I think he's someone to be reckoned with in the field, and certainly influentially. He may have invented this particular genre for this book that we'll talk about. But and even though I don't know, we'll figure it out. We'll figure out how I feel about this book as we talk. But reading this book, you have to talk about the ideas. It's just there's some stuff there to think through. So. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, there are collections of his short fiction called Expanded Universe Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Oh, okay.
And that you can get. Did you ever read All You Zombies? I presume you had to have come across that.
If it's one of those short stories, I have, but it's been a number of years.
So, it's a really short one.
Okay.
But there's an adaptation of it called Predestination that's very good. Mm. Really, really, really like that one.
Nice.
Let's see, what did we have covered why this book. I think we just go ahead and move into the kind of the non-spoiler discussion. I'm a little scattered here. I took a bunch of notes, but I don't have them in my normal format, so I don't have it in front of me, but that's okay. Oh, you mentioned, actually, I need to get a screenshot of your bookcases behind you. You mentioned the Star Trek books. How many Star Trek books do you have back there?
You know, that I don't know. What you guys don't see is what Seth is looking at is my home office, which I finally have brought all of my Star Trek novels from my parents' house in New Jersey to here. And I'm proud of this display. Yeah. I have probably some hundreds. It's not even complete. I have a Word document that's on Google Drive. When I go to like Powell's Books or something, I kind of scan the shelves and see which ones I don't have.
I do the same thing with a list of Hugo winners.
Yeah. There's still a bunch that I haven't read. The more Hugo books that I read, the more grown-up, sophisticated science fiction that I read, the harder I think it is to go back and read some. A lot of them are just like pulpy, silly, boring novels. The only thing is with the Star Trek novel is you don't have to know who the characters are. You don't have to figure out what's going on. It's the Enterprise or whatever. So that's helpful.
Yeah. The universe is already there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tie-in fiction is a wonderful comfort read kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. Are you more focused on original series, Next Generation mixture?
A mixture. Yeah. I've got books from all the series. You know, it's interesting right now, actually, they had done after the last Star Trek movie, which was, the last of the Next Generation, which was Nemesis. Mm-hmm. It was not great or well received. So they thought there were going to be no more Star Trek movies. And so they started to do like a Star Wars style thing where they had an expanded universe of connected novels after that movie.
Yeah.
But then Picard came along, the new TV show, which kind of threw all of that out the window. Mm-hmm. And so what they're doing, there's a trilogy coming out this September, actually, 2021, that's supposed to tie a knot on all of that expanded universe and, I think, reset everything so it makes the Picard universe possible. So it'll be interesting to kind of see what they do with that because it was a whole different set of developments in those books.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and get into kind of the formal non-spoiler discussion of the book?
Yeah, absolutely.
And talk about, you know, elevator pitch for it, quick synopsis, not too many spoilers.
Yeah. So I guess my elevator pitch synopsis would be a classic military science fiction novel that recounts the journey of a privileged young man into the military life during a time of war. And also there's a lot of philosophy in it. So that's
big time.
That's my summation.
Yeah. It's funny because if you've read any military science fiction, at least in my experience, I get it mixed up with this book. There are scenes from the Forever War and from Old Man's War that I thought were in Starship Troopers.
Oh, interesting.
and within those two as well. I'm like, where's the one where the guy's sitting around and the aliens are attacking him, but they're like the size of butterflies. And I think that one's in Old Man's War, but I'm not sure.
Okay. I've read Forever War a while ago. I haven't read Old Man's War. So,
okay.
But it might be, and I haven't tracked the whole history of this, but I think everything else might be, I mean, this may be the book that invented the military, or at least perfected the military science fiction genre. And everything else is kind of maybe in conversation with it afterwards. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The interesting thing about this one is that it is definitely kind of, it fits in with his juveniles, right? When you think about the content in the book, if you put an MPAA rating on it, it's probably PG-13. Mm-hmm. You know, there's very little language that I remember anyway.
Yeah.
The violence in it isn't gratuitous.
No.
And there's no sex.
The most you come is him admiring the form of a woman in a very generic language at one point.
And that's we definitely need to talk about that.
Yeah.
But it's funny because then you look over at the film adaptation and it's gratuitous violence and nudity and sex and profanity, which makes sense given that Verhoeven set out to subvert the book in the adaptation because he hated it. It's kind of brilliant in that sense, doing that with an adaptation, being like, I don't really like this thing. I'm going to make a movie about how I feel about that book.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what came out.
And I do remember back in 97, I was in high school, it was a big splash when it came out. Like, it was not that I think people thought it was great, but it was like a big deal. I think I remembered. I went and saw it in the theater, that kind of thing.
I haven't seen it in years since we did it for Take Me to Your Reader. And I'm curious how the effects hold up, but I suspect this would be one that would be better watched in standard definition. So,
well, I will have to see this week. I think I'm going to try to watch it. So,
All right. Yeah. Let me know. I was going to, I always go over like comps for the book and I already threw out a couple. Yeah. The Forever War is definitely a book that's in conversation with this one because it's much more about the futility of war.
Yeah.
And then Old Man's War is just it's a military science fiction book. Yeah. If you like any of David Weber's stuff, that's also military science fiction, although it's less ground side military. It's more fleets and space and space battles and that kind of stuff where Starship Troopers is much more mobile infantry, boots on the ground kind of stuff.
Yeah, and that boots on the ground kind of mobile infantry and also kind of the boot camp experience, which is a significant portion. I mean, it gets boot camp and that's officer school later on. So it's it's that kind of, it's through one man's eyes too. It's that key thing.
Yes, one man's eyes that you could emphasize.
So yeah, I thought Forever War as well, in a certain sense, and I kind of chuckled about this earlier, in a certain sense, all other military science fiction, but maybe Ender's Game a little. There's some, I mean, especially the school stuff.
Yes.
And I couldn't help but think of Full Metal Jacket, the movie. Mm-hmm. I've only seen that once, but you have this extended boot camp experience, Arleigh Army and everything, and then you transition into war. And so it's this very classic sort of journey, I guess.
Yeah. I've actually not seen Full Metal Jacket all the way through. It's on my list of shame. So.
Oh, well, it's, again, I've only seen it once, but it very much had that. It was boot camp and then war. Two pieces in that. It was almost like two different movies in a certain way.
Yeah. Any other comps?
I mean, like I said, a lot of other military science fiction. I don't read widely in the genre. I mean, I just read, it was one of the nominees for last year, The Light Brigade, which featured war and faster than light travel or something like this. And I think maybe a mech suit. I mean, this mech suit thing is, I think he may have invented or perfected this too. So.
Yeah.
All of that kind of thing that we see in sci-fi well. You know, there's also apparently, I haven't dug deep in this, there's a whole series of like direct to DVD movies. Like there's a Starship Troopers 2 and 3and 4. There's actually a pretty good animated series called Roughnecks that came out back in the 90s, which only was lasted one season, which I did like. So it's not so much a comp, but sort of other things maybe in that genre. But I've never seen anything but the cartoon. I've only seen the original movie. So yeah.
Yeah. Another comp that's just kind of in form rather than in content is All You Need Is Kill, which was the Japanese novel that's turned into Edge of Tomorrow, Live, Die, Repeat.
Yeah.
Where And that one, it's kind of similar to the way Starship Troopers, the book, has this powered armor, you know, that allows them to jump over whole buildings and that kind of stuff. Where in the movie, they just have armor. In Edge of Tomorrow, he has a like an exoskeleton kind of thing, where in the book, it's much more of a bubble. And there's a lot in the book about learning to use the suit without the kind of the suit assisting you. If you want to move fast enough to defeat the aliens, you have to disable the safety protocols more or less, because it can snap you in half if you turn them off.
But okay.
If you don't turn them off, then you're never going to be fast enough. But and that's an interesting book. It's definitely worth a read. Different enough from Edge of Tomorrow that you can be like, I like that movie and I like that book, but they're very different.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, Edge of Tomorrow was one of the most surprising movies I've ever seen, because I went to it thinking, this is not going to be interesting at all. And I liked it. I ended up, I said, oh, this, you know, the expectation I had and the reality of the movie were different enough that I really enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah, I remember seeing that first trailer and thinking, okay, this could be cool. And then I found out that it was adapted from a book. And so I read the book and thought, it looks like I can see some changes that they're going to make.
I just kind of thought, oh, it's Tom Cruise doing something. And it was good. So.
Yeah, I think it's probably time to jump into spoilers.
Yeah, let's do it.
I don't know if we missed any segments, but whatever. I got to turn this thing around quick. So, alrighty. So let's just dive into spoilers, whatever you want to talk about. I have a bunch of notes, but it's just kind of about things that happen in the book. Not so much. I didn't organize it in any way, so expect my thoughts to be scattered.
Yeah, my thoughts are too. I mean, there's a lot of thematic things that I think I'd like to talk about. I mean, the plot itself is fairly simple. He joins the war. He trains. He fights. Some people die around him. He grows. Yeah. It's a coming of age novel, you know.
One thing that I really like about it that separates it from a book like Ender's Game is there is nothing particularly special about Johnny.
Yeah.
He is just kind of, he's not even sure he wants to join up, but it's kind of the first decision that he's been able to make on his own.
Yeah. His father has a plan for him and he says, no, I want to do this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so it is just kind of a, you know, Johnny goes to war kind of thing, and there's nothing special about him. It just happens that he's one of the people who survives.
Yeah, you know, the bare plot, I mean, science fiction setting aside and some of the philosophical discussion aside, the bare plot lines could take place for any young soldier in any war, potentially.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing.
So where you get into the weeds of the philosophy parts are the poll tax idea and, you know, earning your citizenship, where, you know, we come from a country where we have birthright citizenship.
Exactly.
And you don't have to do anything to earn the right to vote. You can lose the right to vote in a number of ways, but like the idea of getting the franchise by having to serve your term. And I thought it was interesting. I didn't remember this, that serving soldiers don't have the franchise, right?
You have to finish your term and be discharged.
Finish your term. And of course your term is at the discretion of the federal service.
Yeah. What is it? 3 years or for the duration, whatever they say the duration for is.
As long as, as we need you.
Yeah. I mean, I guess going back to plot a little bit, I mean, there's an alien attack or there's alien incursion and then eventually attacks on Earth. They call these aliens the Bugs. They are a spider-like alien race, very that's communitarian or almost a share a hive mind type of thing.
Right.
So that's probably important, especially when we come into some of the politics of it as well. But that's important to keep in mind. So it's an enemy they don't understand, partially.
I do think it's interesting that it's – at the very end of the book, you find out that Johnny is from the Philippines, and it's never mentioned any other place in the book, or at least he's Filipino. We don't know where he's really from. But
that's another notable thing. You know, this book's written late 50s, you know, I don't know much about Heinlein's perspectives on race, but it doesn't, I mean, it posits a kind of post-racial society where these things don't even particularly matter. So.
There's a couple of places where he has like a character of color who looks like they're speaking with a bit of a patois, and I don't like the way that's written in books. I don't like it when Mark Twain does it. I don't like it really when anyone does.
Yeah. You know, I listened to it. I'm not sure if that came through or I didn't recall it, but that would be, but that was, you know, you get the sense that Johnny isn't from the United States, which the United States doesn't, I guess, really exist anymore in this future that they posit. But from the Philippines, you don't find out till almost the very end, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, to go back to your conversation about the poll tax, I mean, if there's one of the big ideas in the book is exactly that you have to, in order to vote or have a voice in your government, you have to have performed. It's not, you don't have to have fought. You have to serve you have to serve a kind of military term, which could be not quite civilian, which could be support, but it has to be a kind of military service.
Well, it's federal service, right?
Yeah, that's what it is, federal service. Yeah,
or federation service.
Yeah. The history of this, right, is that, I guess, in Heinlein's world here, after the 50s, somehow things come around. So Russia and the United States ally against China. They have this big war, but the Western countries just fall apart into degradation and juvenile delinquency, in his words.
Right.
And then there's just chaos afterwards. And finally, starting in, I think, Edinburgh, some military veterans say, you know what? No, we're going to run things now. And so with no clear plan, they just, this system just kind of takes effect. And it seems to be working, I guess, is the idea.
Yeah, and there's definitely some troubling stuff in there about the juvenile delinquency and basically blaming the parents, right? And saying that basically if the parents had spanked their kids, then everything would have been better.
Yeah. I mean, if you spanked your kids, if you had more discipline, everything's falling apart. Which, again, thinking about when Heinlein is writing, I mean, you have the youngest baby boomers would be 12, 13 here. There's already that youth kind of beatnik movement in the 50s. So he's, as a World War II veteran, he's looking around probably and saying, what's up? What's going on here? This is not going well.
Yeah,
and
that kind get of, off my lawn.
Exactly. You know, Clint Eastwood and Gran Torino type of
exactly.
moment. Exactly.
Very much. Yeah.
But what is interesting, though, is there's this really interesting part of the novel. It's late, chapter 12, where they talk about it's an officer training school. And they say, why? And they ask the students, why do you think we do this? Why does this work? And eventually what it comes down to is they say, you need to have, if you're going to have authority, you need to have, or you need to have responsibility.
Right.
And what Heinlein seems to be saying, at least through one of the characters, is in his vision of what emerging mid-century American democracy and Western European democracy was, is you had all sorts of authority, but you didn't have to own up to the consequences of what you voted for. And until the end, when you had to own up to all of it because you destroyed your society and then it's too late.
Right. Well, I mean, in a democracy, we get the leaders we deserve in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah.
It's not an accident that anybody gets elected.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
The responsibility and authority reminds me of, I had a coworker who was a chopper mechanic in the Army for a long time. Okay. And I joked with him one time. I said, so the pilots pay you extra to make sure you do a good job? And he said, oh no, when we finish work on a chopper, next time it goes up, we go up with it. So you have a vested interest in making sure that thing stays in the air.
You do. And I think that's some of what Heinlein's saying. And it's, you know, it's interesting just to think about American politics even now. I mean, in the last, this is a big question, especially the boomer presidents, but, you know, Clinton didn't fight in Vietnam, maybe dodging the draft. Bush stayed back in the Texas Air National Guard.
Yeah.
You know, Trump did not serve, you know, although he went to military school, and these were questions that people had, you know.
Yeah.
On the other hand, people worry about military leaders, you know, having too much power too. So there's both this appreciation for, in the United States, for people who served, thank you for your service, you know, I'm not denigrating that, but there's also this, you know, this, we have a tradition of civilian leadership, and we've had only a few generals serve as president over our nation's history.
Yeah, Grant, you know, Eisenhower.
Washington,
yeah.
One or two of those 18th century ones that died quickly, but
yeah.
Yeah, it's people call Heinlein for this book a fascist.
Right.
And he actually does talk about, oh gosh, what is it? The the rods and the axe, which is the great fascist symbol too at one point in the book. This idea that, you know, and fascism, oh gosh, I'm not a fascist, but I mean, fascism often, less like communism, gets tied into the excesses by people who did things in that name. So fascism at its core is this idea that there's strength through unity, which, you know, which has its own problems, just like whatever. But mostly because we remember that fascism was marshaled in the forces of hate and genocide, which horrible and deplorable. But this, but it's interesting to see Heinlein here in the 50s potentially exuding a fascist idea.
Yeah.
When you would think that would be pretty discredited by, you know, by the 50s.
Yeah, I can't remember how much he served in the military. I know he was in the Navy, but had, I can't remember what it was he had. That,
you know, I think I read he was an officer, but I don't know how much action or fighting he saw, but he did serve.
There's a lot of macho in this book.
Yeah.
And, and it's very much written, you know, if you're, when Hugo Girl does this one, I'm sure they'll tear it apart for being as chauvinistic as it is, because women are seen as this, well, women exist, therefore we serve, you know, they're the motivating factor because women exist, we know that there's good in the world or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not great. But there, at some point, he gets a letter from his mom. Johnny gets a letter from his mom because he has signed up against his father's wishes. And his mom mentions that his dad won't even speak Johnny's name, and that's his way of grieving. And she says, quote, since he cannot cry.
Yeah.
And I think, I understand that that is a reality of the way men of a certain age and era think.
Yeah.
But I feel like we've definitely moved past that now.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. I mean,
Though I've been, I just recently listened to the book Jesus and John Wayne.
Okay, yeah,
and,
I read
and,
that one.
And all about the kind of macho influences on Christianity and the muscular Christianity.
Yeah, yeah. And if you listen to that Mars Hill podcast, you hear that too. So,
yeah.
Well, I mean, then the macho thing, I mean, line one of the book, there's a little quotation in front of every chapter or most chapters. And the opening quotation of the book is, come on, you apes. You want to live forever? Unknown platoon sergeant, which is just about the most macho thing you can say, right? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's a whole chapter where I think there's several verses out of the Bible that lead into the chapters.
Yeah.
As a quote. And one of them is, you know, train up a child in the way that he should go.
Yeah.
And that's it, going into the basic training and kind of having that philosophy about man has no moral instinct. And because he has that history of moral philosophy or whatever it, whatever that class is called. And of course, you know, I completely reject the idea that man has no moral instinct. I don't. Calvinists might agree with it.
Well, they might say their moral instinct is wrong, but it's still a moral instinct. It's just an immoral instinct, I suppose.
Yeah. To be fair to Calvinists, I don't like Calvinism, but that's an unfair characterization. Yeah. They would say that, you know, regeneration precedes faith, right? You can't reach for God without his assistance.
So going back to the voting, though, there's something interesting here. He talks about, I think, voting, the exercise of electoral authority, as a kind of violence, right? He says, and this ties in, I suppose, to his philosophy, or at least the book's philosophy. I don't want to put this all on Heinlein. Maybe he's speaking within their voice, but this idea that violence does actually settle things. You know, there's an early scene where they're in high school and they're in this moral philosophy class, which oddly enough, everyone has to take, but no one has to pass. You just have to have taken it, which as an instructor, I thought, oh, that's never going to work. Why is anyone doing anything at all?
Yeah.
The students in this class are really just talking and asking questions. And I'm like, no way, not in my class. If it didn't count, they would just sort of be zoned out. But they asked this question and there's a young lady in the class. She says, well, my mom or my dad says that violence never settles anything. And he says, oh, you should ask the people of Carthage about that, you know, who famously the Romans, you know, destroyed and razed the city. So there's, and then of course, tying that into voting, he says, you know, well, voting is a kind of exercise of authority, which is a kind of violence, which I guess maybe does have impact and does settle some things.
Right.
So again, tying the martial emphasis in voting.
Yeah. And when you look at the way people react to voting from their perspective wrongly, right, they will see that as a violent act in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's I suppose it's intriguing a little bit to think about this book at this particular season in American history and American politics, where, you know, every American or most Americans would say, we believe everyone has the right to vote. But when your side doesn't win, whether it be one side or the other, you act like everyone else who voted for the other, well, guy so far in American history, for the most part, is wrong and an idiot and shouldn't really be allowed to vote because they're stupid. You know, and depending on where our perspectives are, we may have felt that ourselves from time to time. So there is this temptation, right? I think to think that the uninformed shouldn't vote. The people that don't do this or that don't vote. The people who, you know, on one side might say the people who are on assistance or welfare should not vote, or the people that are, you know,
The
wealthiest shouldn't really have they have an outsized say and so on and so forth. And so, it's
that's funny. That reminds me of the famous Baldwin-Buckley debate where Buckley essentially said at some point, it's not that black people aren't voting, you know, that black people shouldn't be allowed to vote. It's that fewer white people should be able to vote. You know, he wanted to restrict the franchise even further than it was because he felt like not the right kind of white people were voting. His kind.
Yeah. And, you know, If you go back in American history, and I'm not defending this from the founders, but you see, I mean, the whole republic is set up, you know, electoral college initially, the Senate's not directly elected. you have to have, there's a land holding thing. It was assumed that women maybe weren't of a right mind to vote. It was kind of trying to limit democracy from what the founders might have seen as the excess of the masses, you know, because the masses can't be trusted with demagogues and things like this.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So I think, you know, you mentioned about the poll tax and the idea that citizenship isn't birthright. It's earned through federal service and that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of people will maybe unfairly say that's what Heinlein thought. And I'm not sure that is what he thought. I think, you know, it's possible as an author to say, hey, here's what's happening in the world of this book without prescribing it.
Yeah.
The problem is that once it's out there, then people can take that and go, yeah, actually, that's a really good idea, you know, and the idea can be misused. But I don't know what he actually thought about it. So
yeah,
if there's somebody on here, there who does know, let me know.
Yeah, please let us know. You know, I listened to, Astounding. It was a biography, John W. Campbell and some of the other guys, including Heinlein. And so it was last year, but I learned a little bit more about Heinlein there. You know, what's interesting, Wikipedia, when I was looking at it today, says that Heinlein wrote this novel as a protest against the cessation of nuclear military testing by the United States government in the late 50s, as if to say we're kind of giving up on maybe victory against the communists or something like this, and he was maybe concerned about this. So if that's accurate, and again, that's Wikipedia. I don't know who put that in there. I don't know where that comes from. If that's accurate, it does kind of contextualize a little bit and make me think, well, Heinlein is trying to say something here. Maybe not the voting thing, but definitely that kind of a what we might call a realpolitik, that violence actually matters. And you can say all sorts of nice things about about the use of force not making a difference, but Heinlein might say it does. And so we can't just be Pollyannish about this.
Yeah, all the nuclear brinksmanship. I'm a little older than you, right?
Yeah. I'm born in 80. Yeah. I think you're
72. So it's not that far off. Mm-hmm. Still growing up during the Cold War, right?
Yeah. And for me, it was over by the time I realized what it was.
Right. Yeah. You were still in grade school when the Berlin Wall fell, where I was in high school and taking German from a lady who grew up in East Germany.
Wow.
So a lot of that kind of one-upsmanship and trying to keep the lead in the arms race, it's kind of insane.
Yeah. You know, it absolutely is. But I think that there's a mindset of people, maybe Heinlein's mindset, or certainly a lot of people at that time is, if we give up and fall behind, we'll just be decimated because then that's it. And so it just, I suppose it felt like a no-win scenario. And so if it's a no-win scenario, we at least want to win a little more than the other person.
Yeah.
Or lose a little less.
Have you ever read Alas, Babylon?
Is it a full novel or a short story?
It's a novel by Pat Frank.
No, I don't think I have.
There's a nuclear exchange in that. And at some point you finally get a view into what happened. And and somebody says, we got them real good. Not that it matters because, of course, they got real good as well. But that's a good book. You know, going back to is this Heinlein's perspective? You know, I compare this novel with a book like Double Star, which has this very... I love that book. I thought it was great. And I loved it was almost optimistic, right? About, hey, we can have, you know, a leader who's really high-minded and wants to bring people together and wants to like say, hey, let's not be racist against the Martians or whoever. So yeah, I thought that book was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been a little bit, but yeah, I did. It was definitely very different from this. It's interesting. This is different from that, is different from Stranger in a Strange Land, which I haven't read Moon as a Harsh Mistress, I think, yet, but I assume is different again from that. So,
yeah. And that's like a libertarian manifesto.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think Heinlein, again, is one of the greats, one of the great mid-century science fiction writers. You really can see even in his Hugo winners. I mean, the man won, what, 4 Hugos for novels? I mean, just the differences in maybe some of the things that he's bringing to the table with those.
Yeah. Kind of going back to that macho thing and the, you know, toxic masculinity of everything is the fact that his father ends up signing up.
Was very against the military initially.
Yeah. Very, very against it in the beginning. But then, you know, and this is the stuff I don't like in the book. I like the father son stuff in that I'm glad that they kind of found each other again. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, my dad died in 2014 and I miss him. And so I'm going to be a sucker for that kind of stuff in any book I read. But the notion that his father joined up because he realized that he had never really become a man. And essentially the book is saying military service is the only way to become a man. And I very strongly reject that notion. Yeah. I think there's tons of very good people who go into the military but there's some jerks in there too. There's some people who are not good people. And going to the military doesn't change that necessarily. It might round off some edges and that kind of stuff. Yeah. And it's an honorable thing to do, but you don't have to pick up a gun to be a man.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. This is the danger of listening to the audiobook. Did he actually say that he joined the military because he felt like he needed to be a man? Was that a statement?
Yeah, there was something in there. I didn't write down the exact quote.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it was essentially that he decided he had never really become a man. You know, I will say, you know, I read this book in practically 24 hours. You know, it goes down easy.
That's a very different experience in listening to it over 2 weeks that I did. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet. Because, you know, I like listening to audio when I'm driving or doing a task or something, but it's much slower than taking it in reading, especially for something that I've already read three or four times. Yeah. Because this is the other thing. This is one of my dad's favorite books. And before he passed away, before they moved down to Oregon, when they still lived in Alaska, anytime they'd come down to visit us, they'd go over to Lincoln City on the Oregon coast to the outlet malls there. And he'd go into the bookstores and invariably he'd come back with, you know, three or four science fiction books, and he'd always pick up a copy of Starship Troopers and read it again and then leave it. And I'd donate it to the library. And at some point I decided, well, I guess I had to read this one. And so I read it, you know, and talked about it with my dad, and I don't even remember what we talked about.
So I'm curious, why was it your father's favorite book? Do you have a sense of that?
I don't know. I mean, my dad was always a World War II buff. And so, yeah, okay. So there's something about the basic training thing, and he never got drafted, for okay. Vietnam. He could have been, because he was of the right age. I think, let's see, that would have been late 60s. So, you know, had a couple of kids, was in a doctoral program.
Okay.
So probably got passed over because of that. Mm-hmm. But he always really admired, some of the great minds of military strategy. And he was very, very connected with the Pacific campaign, Nimitz and those kind of guys. He loved books like The Winds of War, by Herman Woke. And it was just kind of a lifetime hobby of his, that I wish I'd picked up more of. Like I said, it's a pretty easy read. It's an enjoyable read. If you're just wanting to read a cool boot camp experience, you know, there's fun stuff with Sergeant Zim kicking everybody's butts, you know, at the beginning saying, okay, I mean, who thinks they can take me?
It is so classic and so great. I mean, just you know, it feels like the closest I will ever get to military service.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the closest I ever want to get to military service for that matter. It just sounds horrible. And, but Zim is a powerful character, and you see a little of Zim's humanity. He's the ultimate kind of macho guy, and you see a little bit of breaking, and maybe even with Dubois, I think is how they pronounce it in the audiobook, his who's a former lieutenant commander, who is his high school moral philosophy teacher.
Right.
You see, once Johnny gets through basic training, Dubois reaches out to him almost in a fatherly kind of, there's a warmth to it that is not just the coldness of the military experience. So, but he had to earn that, you know?
I'd be curious if there is, and somebody will have to let me know, you know, Haley and Lori and everybody from Hugo Girl, is there a book like this written with a female main character? Because if there is, I'd love to read it. That would be interesting to see how things would be different.
Yeah.
Certainly some of the gender politics here are really weird. The idea that, you know, forward of Bulkhead 30 or whatever it is, that's where the women live. And if you
who are much better at being pilots.
Right. And so I'm like, is this an anti-sexist thing saying that women are better pilots? Is he trying to subvert the women can't drive nonsense that men seem to think?
But it is interesting because he specifically says women are supposed to be better pilots. And I think Johnny says, and they are. They're much better pilots. They are not. Yeah. They don't mess up like we do and things like that. And also women are serving in the military, but they do not serve as ground troops is the thing.
Yeah. And the men seating the women in the wardroom or wherever it is, you know, around the table.
I mean, for the most part, this book is, even though women appear, it's rare, and the book feels like 99% male.
Absolutely.
Like the characters, like,
yeah,
which is why when they made the movie, I think they had more of a mixed fighting force, and that's Denise Richards' role. She's a ground trooper, I think, alongside.
No, she's a pilot, actually.
Oh, she is. Okay.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of the actor who plays Dizzy. But she's a ground troop. She's mobile infantry.
Yeah, a Hispanic actress, I think, right? Or
The red-haired.
Maybe wrong. Oh, yeah, I'll have to watch the movie. But you know, it's they had to basically invent a bunch of stuff. I think extra, outside of the book for that movie, simply because there would have been 5 minutes worth of acting for a female actor if there was one in the movie. You know, very little to do.
Yeah, they definitely changed that. I mean, that's a good change. Some of the other stuff, like very much putting the officers in the military in SS uniforms.
I'm going to have some watching to do.
It is not subtle, that movie.
To go back to the gender stuff, I think as enlightened perhaps as Heinlein might be about women's ability to serve and fly starships and be better pilots, obviously the book, I'm sure the male gaze term may have existed before this, but there's a scene in the book where he stands on a corner when he's on leave and he just says, "Girls, aren't they great? Just the way they move." And he just, it goes on. Like the audiobook, I feel like it's 5 minutes of him just talking about how much he loves girls and how they walk and all sorts of things like that. And it reminds me of the movies, even from the 90s, where you have the slow pan on the woman and the slow motion with the wind blowing, you know, all these kind of things. And it's
and then soft focus, like in old Star Trek.
Yeah. The soft focus in old Star Trek. I mean, it's not something that would be received or should be, I think, received very well today.
Reminded me of Ron Weasley in whichever the movie was with the raging hormones, where he's like, "I like the way they walk."
Yeah. Although, the one thing I would say is, we don't tend to like the idea of the male gaze today, but I do imagine that probably the experience of a male soldier that hasn't seen a woman in 6 months seeing women on the street of a city probably would experience it like that, you know, in his mind.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be inaccurate to be a little icky.
Yeah. True enough. Yeah. It's like, well, why go into this detail, Heinlein, you know, this kind of thing.
Right. Well, that's, you know, like we said, he was a Navy man. So there are some stereotypes about Navy guys.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Should we talk about the bugs a little bit? Would that be?
Yeah, let's do that. It is interesting. Why don't you go ahead and leave that one off?
I think that people who read this, and I can see it, see the bugs as an analog for communism, and people who are wanting to, you know, quote a hive mind kind of even go on, and also potentially as a kind of an analog potentially for Chinese or Asian communism. There's a racial potential element here as well, too. Mm-hmm. So obviously you can see it. And it is, that's where the book, I think, for a lot of people becomes very problematic.
Yeah. And I mean, you can read that kind of stuff into it. You would think, like I said earlier, that Johnny is Filipino. There is a Japanese character who's one of the other recruits who's son of this legendary colonel, you know, that can go toe to toe with Sergeant Zim. There are Asian characters, but you know, that then looks like tokenism as well. Mm. You don't get a lot of descriptions of what people's races are, other than a few characters.
You know, and I don't think it has to be about race, certainly.
No.
I think, though, it certainly seems to be about communism. You know, I mean, there's even a one portion where they go on this sort of discourse about how do you fight an enemy that doesn't care about whether somebody dies or not. Human beings, we care. We go rescue. We would rather lose two men saving one than let somebody go leave behind. But the bugs, they don't care.
I mean, they're talking about the bugs hatch ready to fight, right?
Yeah.
Where you have to train a human for a long time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if it takes a year to train a soldier, you can lose 1,000 bugs to every one soldier, and still those losses are bad for the human side.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to dehumanize this enemy. They're already not human. So I think that's kind of this whole thing.
Well, and you don't really have to question the conflict at all. Where in the movie, I feel like it leans a little towards the whole thing was a false flag in some way, especially when you start to consider relativity and the distances between planets. It does not make any sense at all. It is interesting, too, in this book that there's no talk of relativity or time debt, the kind of stuff that you get in the Forever War.
Yeah. It's if it doesn't really matter. They have their Cherenkov drive, and they just whatever the magic Cherenkov drive, and it just works, you know.
So. I look at it; it's got to be a warp drive where it keeps you from experiencing relativistic effects. Otherwise, none of it makes any sense.
I do have my Star Trek: The Next Generation technical manual on the shelf, so you know.
I used to have that one,
but I mean, did it come off to you? I mean, would you say that a read of the bugs would be sort of communist? Does that seem like an adequate?
Yeah, I think so. With the hive mind and the fact that, you know, they all kind of work together towards a common goal. The imperialistic kind of idea of we need to drive them off these planets, you know, we need to push them out, keep pushing them away further. And that, you know, that was part of US geopolitics for a long time. That's why we intervened in Korea and Vietnam.
Because the so-called domino effect.
Yeah. Because communist aggression had to be pushed back.
Yeah. And in 59, it's post-Korea. I don't know if things are quite heating up in what would be French Indochina or Vietnam at that point, but we're nearly there. So, well, maybe around that time. So, yeah. And certainly this concern about encroachment, you know, containment was the idea for the Soviet Union, I think, in the military or geopolitical philosophy at the time. So,
Suffice it to say, you can read this book and just read it as a fun boot camp, you know, military science fiction thing and not think too deeply about it. If you're going to engage with the ideas, you might come across some pretty troubling ideas, some things to talk about.
Yeah, I mean,
we're definitely not going to cover all of it in this discussion.
Oh, no. I mean, I keep going back to this voting, this suffrage question, right? And it's not so much about whether people, you know, Heinlein's question about whether people need to do federal service to vote, but this question of what he calls responsibility and authority. The idea that if you don't, I think what he's trying to say is if you don't, if what you decide for everybody doesn't ever affect you,
that's
not good for society, I think is what he'd say. And I think that a lot of people might say that about the richest of the rich. They can support all sorts of ideas that damage the environment. It's not going to hurt them, you know, but they'll make that decision. Or vice versa. Someone might say, oh, all those people that voted for Donald Trump, they're not going to, you know, whatever it is, you know, it's not going to affect, it's not going to affect them, but it might affect people in here, there, the other place. So it is.
Well, you get into this with discussions about should you get vaccinated or not, right? Where an argument for getting vaccinated is I don't want to pass something on to somebody I don't even know, or you know, potentially don't even know. Someone else ends up dying because of a choice that I made. You know, for me, the choice was obvious. I'm like, I'll get the vaccine as soon as possible to protect myself and protect people around me and even people that I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, to use the logic of Heinlein's book, which I'll be stretching way too far here for the next few seconds, is you have the authority to choose to, in your little sphere of influence, decrease the likelihood that someone might get the virus and die, or you have the authority to not do that. And you don't necessarily have to face that responsibility. Now, you might if you don't, and then you, God forbid, you know, catch the virus and die. But it's a microcosm in some sense of what's going on here. So it's just one of these classic, I mean, I think on my shelf back at my university, a classic book from like the 50s called Major Problems of American Democracy Visualized. It's hilarious, but it's like little drawings. But I feel like this is, in a representational democracy, this is a question that probably may perennially come up.
Yeah.
If the stakes in which you are voting don't impact you, what does that say about you, you know, and what should there be safeguards there and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I won't solve that here, guys. Sorry, but that's the question, you know, which is one of the things I think I like about this book, as separate, I mean, from everything else. I mean, the boot camp stuff is interesting. I wanted more action, but that's just me, you know, but the questions really, I mean, you could, if you're reading this in a book club, for instance, I mean, this could be the stuff of significant conversation. This
definitely
would be a great book. I mean, I've wanted to do for a while a class called Science Fiction and Theology or something. Now this one would be more of a science fiction and politics. This would be a great read for that, but just sort of unpacking the significant questions that raises.
And I mean, that's where books like They'd Rather Be Right come in, the science fiction.
Here we go again,
We talked about that one. Any other thoughts on this one?
One thing that I read as I was doing a little research, again, this does come from Wikipedia. If any of my students are listening, I apologize. But apparently,
it's going to cost you a letter grade.
I know, there we go. But letter grade, or at least, you know, do I have other footnotes that are better? One of the things that apparently was one of the things that was posited or in dialogue with Heinlein's book here is, I think at one point he says something like, there's nothing better than a person can do than give their life for their country, right? Or to die. And he may have actually quoted Jesus at one of these headings where it says, greater love hath no man than this, that he would lay down his life for his brothers, right?
Right.
And so you get the sense that what Jesus is saying there is like relinquishing your life for someone else, you know,
yeah,
interposing yourself so that someone else doesn't die, not picking up a gun and murdering them all, which certainly isn't what, you know, the scripture sure. testifies to Jesus. But, you know, Heinlein seems to be saying that's the idea. This is what these Marines do. They die so that others don't have to. And then the conversation about Heinlein's book was that old poem by, I think, Wilfred Owen, Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, which stands for it is fitting and proper for one to die for one's own country. And they in the poem, it's a post-World War I poem, they call it the old lie, that this is that this is what people say, but this is not actually true, because it would be better if these soldiers in Flanders Field were still alive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not fitting and proper that they were cut down. So
that reminds me of George Michael did an album in 1990 called Listen Without Prejudice, Volume 1. Mm-hmm. I always wished that we got a Volume 2 because it's a fantastic album. But one of the songs on there is called Mother's Pride. And in the interlude of the song, he sings, and all the husbands, all the sons, all the lovers gone, they make no difference in the end. Still hear the women say, your daddy died a hero. Yeah. It's a beautiful anti-war song. I'm not sure I completely agree that they make no difference, but it's a haunting song called Mother's Pride.
Yeah, and you know, it is. And in some sense, I guess it may depend upon the moment, because if you live through World War I, right, which is what this poem is about, of course you wonder what was that all about, right?
Yeah.
Then if you live through the Second World War and you discover death camps, you think, I know what that, you know, you start to think, I know what that was about. Mm-hmm. Then Korea, then Vietnam. And then, you know, some people have been asking, what was that even all about in the last few weeks here as the United States has pulled out of Afghanistan and, and everything else, the horrible things that have happened. What was that all about? And so that's when I think people ask those questions, you know, and I suppose maybe Heinlein is still drawing maybe on that World War II vision that, oh, this did make a difference, you know, whereas so many other military, it may be that World War II is sort of its own kind of character, like few other wars where there's some clear moral sort of moral imperatives here. Whereas so many other, and not that it was pure, believe me, there were lots
going
on. The firebombing of Dresden.
Right. Not to say that everything that happened in World War II. Yeah, it was good.
The bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, all of this kind of stuff. I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. And all the little tiny things that we didn't even read about that are kind of hidden away. But, you know, there's a famous quote from Bart Simpson. He says, there were only three good wars, right? The Civil War, World War II, and something else. It's from like the first season of the Simpsons, you know, it's a joke that he's making. But yeah, it might be that Heinlein is drawing on that kind of vision in the late 50s that as it turns out, doesn't pan out as commonly as one might think. So.
Yeah. Interesting book.
It is. It is.
Yeah. And so did you decide if you like it?
Yes, I do like it. Yeah. I like it. That's a binary choice. I won't say how much. I think I like it 7 out of 10. I don't know. I like it. And now that I remember what it is, there was a lot less action than I remembered, probably because I read it, then I watched the movie, then I haven't read it again in 25 years. But knowing what it is, I want to hand this to some people and be like, let's talk about this, because this is something that I think is worth thinking through.
You know, I had read this in the last 10 years cause I did it for Take Me to Your Reader. But I didn't remember any of the officer candidate school part. Everything that I remembered was up through the end of boot camp and his first kind of tour in the war. So,
yeah. And officer candidate school is funny because it's kind of like, I mean, he even says it's like boot camp part two, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, you've read it 3 or 4 times. I know it was a favorite book of your dad's. Do you like it, would you say? I mean,
I do. Yeah, I do like it. I mean, it's an enjoyable read. There's things to talk about in it, and I think there's value in that. I don't absolutely love it, but like I said, you know, I'll take an easy read 9 times out of 10 over a difficult read that might be a better book. Though I do of course enjoy those as well. But this was an easy one for me to knock off just because I have read it a few times.
Yeah. You know, it did make me want to, as I said, watch the movie, but also watch this animated series called Roughnecks, which was actually pretty well done. It only lasted a season. I think I watched it when I was in graduate school. I had mono for like a couple weeks, and a friend of mine had the VHS tapes, and I sat. That was my, like, that was what I did when I was sick for those weeks. I watched all these episodes, and it was kind of a blast. So it's kind of a fun way to kind of continue some of the story or something like that.
Yeah, I'd be interested to, you know, if somebody adapted it you know, rebooted it, which is the mm-hmm. thing that everybody does now.
Yeah.
If they would hew a little closer to the source, because with, you know, the technology has come along so that they could, they could render that powered armor really well, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
The problem with it, of course, with powered armor is then you can't show the beautiful faces of all the actors. And nobody wants that.
We could save money on actors, right?
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, they've done that on the stuff like The Expanse, so...
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, Edge of Tomorrow, obviously, the Tom Cruise and movie mm-hmm. there. I mean, they had those powered suits, I think, in the yeah. movie and The Expanse and things like that. So, I mean, I think the question would be, and I think I saw this online as well, is what do you do with these themes that some people raise significant yeah. question marks about? Because you'd have to create a lot more action, and you'd need to anyway. It's just there's a lot of exposition and classroom time in this book, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you wanted to render any of that, you'd have to decide what your take on it was, right? If you want to render
it,
you know, according to what your intention or what your thoughts of what the author's intentions were.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to be really death of the author about if I found out what Heinlein really thought, I wouldn't really factor it into my thinking about what it says to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I would factor it in as if you came up with it or another person reading the book. I wouldn't take Heinlein's opinion of it and with more weight than anyone else's, just because I feel like if you didn't make it really, really clear in the book, you don't have any right to tell me what you thought. So,
yeah, I mean, and I know you're kind of the expert on adaptations, but what I would say is I wouldn't want a movie of this to be made without grappling with some of the big questions that he's actually raising. Like this whole responsibility and authority thing I go back to is a really interesting question. And I think, mm-hmm. there could be a 21st century American way to ask those questions that was insightful and intriguing. But to pass by this without those kind of things, I think would be maybe missing an important kind of reflection.
I mean, I'm curious. There are a lot of countries that have mandatory service, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Switzerland, I think, has theirs, and Israel, obviously. And
famously, yeah. I heard, you know, in South Korea –
yeah,
I got this at the Olympics this year. If you win a medal in South Korea, you were from the Olympics, you were excused from your military service. So I thought that was interesting because I guess their baseball team was possibly going to get a medal. I'm not sure if they ended up winning or not, but
I don't remember. I didn't follow it closely enough. I mean, is that kind of mandatory service, is that wrong? You know, you even look at Mormon kids, right? In the Mormon church, they grow up, they're supposed to go and do a mission, right? And that very much invests them in their own faith.
Yeah. I just ran into a few the other day while I was going for a walk. So, you know, they're out there doing it, you know, and, now they don't, I don't know in those countries, Israel, South Korea, et cetera, I don't know that they tie this to, the ballot or to voting. I don't know of any country in the planet that's, you know, does this. You know,
but I will say, having visited Israel in the last few years, mm-hmm. it's a little disconcerting, you know, getting on a bus and then, you know, at a random place, having someone who looks 16 hop on the bus with a semi-automatic rifle.
Well, I mean, the other thing about military service as tying to the vote, I mean, there's the old adage, right? To a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if depending on the kind of especially young, impressionable people that the military is potentially teaching how to fight, because that's what the military does, then the question is that just sort of instilling a kind of that perspective, that single choice perspective in the lives of folks?
Yeah. You know? And that reminds me of even some of the discussions about defunding the police, right? Which people of maybe not the best intentions caricature as, oh, you're going to put in a community worker against a mass shooter. No, nobody was suggesting that at any time. Yeah. We're just saying that there are certain situations where you send people in with guns and somebody gets shot and you go, well, how did that happen? I'm like, well, because you sent in people with guns to a situation that maybe we didn't need people with guns. Certain situations we want to send in the people with guns, but not all of them. So.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that kind of complication, I think, but then the question is, right, if someone were to say, well, then we'll expand the franchise and the vote to people who do all different kinds of service, then the question is what counts as service and what doesn't, you know? And then and then I think you say, well, I think if you're part of the body politic, the American population, you are both responsible for everybody else. And there's kind of this ideally a kind of civic virtue, but that, you know, that gets strained, you know, and I think
if they did another adaptation of this and they wanted to show kind of the universal service, if you want to get citizenship or really, if you think about, I'm curious in some of those countries that have mandatory service, if the privileged people have a way of getting their kids out of the more dangerous posts to get that check mark, you know, using some nepotism or some legacy things that, mm-hmm. that happen that keep the 1% in the 1% generation on generation. You know, you'd see things like that. I'd be curious to see that in an adaptation of this.
Oh, that would be interesting. Cause then you could see the shadow side of it too. Cause they're living mm-hmm. in their quote unquote little utopia here. You know, everything's working just great. You know, everybody's, mm-hmm. you know, but
yeah,
I found it interesting. And I think even this conversation shows it brings up a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do invite people to continue the conversation if you want to on Twitter or wherever, if you have some different opinions on this or something we just completely missed, which always happens.
Oh, there's a lot of things here. So, yeah.
In the shower tomorrow morning, I'll be like, oh, yeah, I meant to talk about that. but even when I take like really detailed notes, there's always stuff that I forget.
Oh, one last thing. We don't need to talk about this, but I think I like the idea that everybody fights. The officers, the chaplains, yeah. I mean, everybody. Nobody gets out of fighting. All of them go down to the planet, you know, when they
have their battle. Even like the guy who was the recruiter who was missing a couple arms or legs, you know, mm-hmm. He shows up with some prosthetics and he's out there. Yeah. And the chaplains too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who, if I was in the military, my most likely position would be chaplain. I don't know how I feel about that, but mm-hmm. it is notable that they're saying that nobody sort of gets out of this. If you're in, you're in. Everybody's,
yeah,
you know.
Well, I think I'm about out of thoughts on this one for now, at least.
Yeah, I think so. I think so too. This was a lot of fun to talk about. Absolutely.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, and thank you again for being flexible and for picking up one of the easier titles for me.
Well, anytime there's a well-known, famous science fiction book that I could talk about that no one else has picked, I'm in. So,
yeah. All right. Well, Josh, where can people find you?
So I do have a blog site that I haven't written on in a little while, but I'm looking to pick it up again, joshuazeifel.com. And I know you'll probably put that in one of your notes or whatnot. Also, the podcast I mentioned, Christianity Now, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And I'm on Twitter at JRZeifel. So that's me.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks again, Josh. It was great talking to you as always, and I'm sure we'll talk again. Okay. Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Josh. It was nice talking to him. Fascinating book. I do invite you, if you have thoughts about this book in particular or any other really thoughts about the podcast, you can find me on Twitter at Hugo's Podcast, or you can reach out feedback@hugospodcast.com or go up to hugospodcast.com and fill out the contact form and send me your thoughts. I am starting to run out of slots left available for this podcast in the future. I think I only have maybe a dozen or so unclaimed titles. So if you want to claim one of those, you can go to one of those places and let me know. And do make sure to check the show notes for Josh's contact info if you want to check out his podcast, Christianity Now. And if you would like to sign up to support this podcast, you can go to patreon.com/HugosPodcast and sign up to support. Or if you want to support us in a non-financial way, just retweet the episode, share them with your friends, leave a review in whatever podcast player or app you use. That would be very much appreciated. I think I mentioned in this podcast a couple times having trouble keeping up with the reading, and that is just the reality of a podcaster's life who does books and also has a life of his own. But I don't want it to come across that I'm not enjoying what I'm doing here, because I very much am, and I hope you're enjoying the podcast. But rest assured, I'm going to persevere. I am going to get through stuff, and I'm enjoying it as I'm doing it. I love the conversations, love getting to know new people. I really enjoy the network of contacts that I've gathered by doing this podcast. It's really been a lot of fun. And so if you're somebody who's been out there lurking, if you want to reach out, you'll find out. I'm fairly personable if you want to say hi. And I think that'll about do it for this time. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.